From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, groups on both sides gear up for a decision on hydraulic fracturing. Our political observer Alan Shartok will share his thoughts on the issue of natural gas drilling, and we'll introduce you to the Yellow Dot program. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Groups for and against fracking are gearing up for an announcement by Governor Cuomo's environmental officials on whether the natural gas drilling process will be permitted in New York on a limited basis. But as the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports, the groups who are running ads may have to wait a little longer.
Industry and business groups that support fracking have been running advertisements for the past several weeks, featuring real people who live in the Marcellus Shale region in New York's Southern Tier and who say they want the natural gas drilling to begin.
I manage the Elmira Corning Regional Airport, and I support the safe and responsible development of shale gas because it'll be good for my county.
Sherry Masur with the Independent Oil and Gas Association, a gas industry lobby group that is helping pay for the ads, says the spots are aimed at showing their support for fracking.
They're sincere, unscripted, genuine comments from people who see firsthand what impact is and what they're expecting for their communities and for their families as well.
Catherine Natto is with Environmental Advocates, which has been fighting for greater health and safety protections if fracking is allowed in New York. She says she doubts New Yorkers are going to be swayed by the industry ads.
I don't think they're going to fall for glitzy ad campaigns and for rosy promises when they look across the rest of the country and realize that everywhere that fracking has gone, water contamination and some very serious community impacts have followed.
Other anti-fracking groups have begun running their own counter-advertisements. One from the Washington, D.C.-based Food and Water Watch features a narrator speaking in the style of Gasland's Josh Fox, and it shows a man lighting the water from his kitchen faucet on fire. It targets Governor Cuomo directly.
Governor Cuomo may soon decide whether or not to allow large-scale hydrofracking in New York State. But the gas company's own science states that 6% of wells fail immediately and 50% fail over 30 years.
Both sides will face a challenge convincing New Yorkers of their point of view. Steve Greenberg, spokesman for Siena College Polling, says the public is split on the issue, with 39% for fracking and 38% against it. Greenberg says politically, for the governor, it's a lose-lose situation.
A politician and elected official's worst nightmare is when the voters are evenly divided and that elected official has to pick A or B.
Greenberg says Governor Cuomo will likely try to mitigate any political damage from the decision that's ultimately made. The governor has already said that home rule will be important when making the decision if fracking does occur. Cuomo spoke to public radio last month.
I think it's inarguable, but that one should take into consideration home rule. And if you have communities that have an expressed desire to proceed, I think that should be taken into consideration. If you decide to go down this road at all, And obviously, if a community says they oppose it, that should be taken into consideration.
The comments give weight to the scenario of permitting a limited number of wells at first, confined to communities who have expressed a desire to begin hydrofracking. Both pro- and anti-fracking groups are anxiously awaiting the decision in the form of a final environmental impact statement due out from the State Department of Environmental Conservation. NADA, with environmental advocates, says she and others will assess the document very closely to determine if fracking is allowed, whether enough safety precautions will be taken.
The devil is certainly in the details on this issue.
Masseur says the oil and gas group is in a holding pattern and reluctant to comment or take action until they actually see the final impact statement from the Cuomo administration.
We are waiting and watching, and we know that there is a process in place, and we're waiting for the resolution of the announcement of the process.
It's unclear how much longer they will have to wait. Governor Cuomo speaking in New York Wednesday, where anti-fracking protesters disrupted an event, says there is no timetable for a decision on fracking. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reporting this week that groups for and against fracking gearing up for an announcement by Governor Cuomo's environmental officials on whether to allow limited natural gas drilling in the state. Pins and needles for many.
That's right. You know, this is one of those issues that really divides New York State. Now, New York City people, whose watershed is protected, and Syracuse, where the watershed is protected, don't seem to, let's put it this way, give a damn, because, you know, their water is protected. So the schnooks everywhere else in the state, including me, will have to perhaps drink water that is that has a problem, that may have some foreign chemical in it, or our kids may have to. Well, I'll tell you, the people who are against this are really passionate. And I think that even though the governor has sort of tipped his hand, that this is something he wants to do, limited basis, you know, you have to vote for it, whatever, foot in the door, I think he's being very careful about it. The one thing we know about Andrew Cuomo is he knows how to go from A to B, and he knows all about political strategy. He's as good at that as anyone. He's tough. He understands it. He knows how to do it. He's been successful as attorney general and as governor so far. And I think he's worried about this one. I do. I have some evidence. I'm not permitted to pass it on, but I have some evidence that he is worried about this. And so I think that this fracking thing, and everybody was expecting that we were going to hear about this, we're going to hear about it before. His latest pronouncements are, well, you know, we want to make sure we get this right and like that. And so I'm one who thinks that if it happens, it's going to happen on a very limited basis.
Let's go to campaign money now, Alan. More than 2,300 campaign committees in New York State failed to file the required financial statements with the State Board of Elections in the six-month period that ended in July. The committees represent more than $31 million in campaign money. And Bill Mahoney of NYPER says the Board of Elections has been anemic in its enforcement of the reporting requirements.
So that's fascinating. You know, the system is loaded. We know it. These commissions and oversight bodies, whether they're ethics or whether the State Board of Elections, they are always the product of both major political parties. Now imagine yourself a legislator. And you have the opportunity to vote, to condemn one of your colleagues. You don't much care about the colleague, but you do care about the precedent it sets and that you might be next. So what's happened is these are all phony bodies. They do very, very little. They put the safe people on them. They know where their bread is buttered. They don't start up. Because if they do start up, and we've seen examples of this in the past, then what happens is they kick them out. And they say, no bread on your table for you. So are we surprised that they can build up these war chests, that they can keep them even after some of them have been convicted of crimes and misdemeanors and the rest? No, we're not surprised, because that's the way the place works.
We've also seen a story this week about Naomi Rivera, a legislator from the Bronx, who's got quite the family, political family, but also being investigated now by state and the FBI over allegedly hiring boyfriends to run organizations.
It won't be the first time. And I'll tell you this, when you look at the case the way that I'm looking at it, I don't know if anybody's going to find anything illegal here, but it's disgusting. I have a wife who is an eminent Holocaust scholar. And every time a Holocaust story comes up, I say, Roselle, you should come on the air. And she says, no, it wouldn't look right for the head of the station, of the radio station's wife, to be there. Well, these people can't pass that smell test. And it's far worse than having a doctoral person who has written books about the Holocaust doing it. So I'm not trying to draw that comparison, but I am saying they should know better. But they get into office and they think it's their right to sort of do these kinds of things. And then they get into terrible trouble and they get on the front page of the tabloids who decide that they can make mincemeat out of them. And you would think that they would just think a little bit ahead of themselves that this is really a bad idea. But it comes down to the A word. No, not that one. It comes down to the word arrogance.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, many of the nation's leaders in STEM education are heading for a Mount Kisco-based company called It's About Time. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
The greatest minds in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education are set to converge on Mount Kisco as It's About Time honors Dr. Gerhard Salinger of the National Science Foundation. The U.S. Department of Commerce predicts careers in STEM fields will experience a 17% growth by 2018, nearly double that of other career choices. IAT co-president Tom Laster says the pioneering educational publisher and consulting firm specializes in creating research-based STEM curriculum solutions for middle and high school.
We saw that there was a tremendous need to improve science and math education. And there was a lot of research that was being done in science and math. And we really saw that there was an opportunity to partner with great educators and partner with the National Science Foundation so that we could have a really good impact.
With funding from the NSF, IAT solutions have empowered thousands of teachers and more than 6 million students. IAT co-founder and president Lori Kreindler says an estimated 14,000 teachers and 1.4 million students will be using IAT curricula this year.
We are 100% devoted to the notion of math and science literacy for all students. And we do it not just through the traditional textbook where people memorize math and science. This is a really unique way of teaching. And what we're finding is students all around the nation that were never thought of themselves as math or science students, all of a sudden are becoming interested in math and science. It started off with just a few schools, and now it's really blossoming around the country.
Some of the larger districts nationwide that have implemented the IAT curricula include public school systems in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York City. Thursday evening, Dr. Salinger will receive the first Kreindler Rowe Impact on Education Award. Since joining NSF in 1989, Dr. Salinger has been instrumental in helping develop nationally disseminated research-based STEM instructional materials that have impacted millions of students across the country.
Well, I've been at the National Science Foundation for over 20 years, and as a program director, people send us proposals and we get them reviewed, and then we have some discretion in getting them funded and deciding exactly what part shall be funded. So over the years, I have funded the development of a number of instructional materials for the K-12 system, mostly high school and middle school, in science. And I've been particularly interested in technology education and engineering. All these materials really are getting students to think about what they're doing and not just memorize, but really try to understand what they're doing.
Dr. Salinger is to be presented with the award at the grand opening of the new IAT headquarters in Mount Kisco, August 23rd at 5 p.m. During the event, IAT will also be hosting a hands-on science fair in its new facility, where 14 of its major NSF-funded middle and high school STEM curricula will be on display.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The Yellow Dot Program is a safety initiative being introduced across New York State. Clinton, Franklin, and Essex County sheriffs announced their participation in the program this week. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there and filed this report.
Sheriff's departments across the state are implementing the Yellow Dot Program to provide emergency responders with critical health information at the site of an emergency. The idea is to place a round yellow sticker provided by the local sheriff's department on your car, which indicates there is a form with medical information in the glove compartment. Essex County Sheriff Richard Cutting says the Yellow Dot Program gives emergency responders information they need.
The Yellow Dot Program provides a visible clue to the officer responding to the scene, to the EMS, to the car accident, or to the house. The little yellow dot shows that there is critical medical information available. We ask that these forms be filled out, be placed in, if it's in the house, place them in a refrigerator, in the freezer. Everybody's got a freezer. The yellow dot indicates that it's there. Put it on the back window of the car. It indicates that there is a medical questionnaire available in the glove compartment. The blood diseases, the allergies, the heart problems, the stroke, it's contact information, it is next to kin, doctors, hospitals. It's those things that the first responders need to know.
Clinton County Emergency Services Director Eric Day says the information provided through the Yellow Dot Program could be essential during the so-called golden hour after an injury or accident.
It's much easier for an EMT to have found this yellow piece of paper that lists all of an individual's medications and medical problems than to have to try and pull that out of somebody in a stressful situation. Generally speaking, it's the goal of the emergency medical community to initiate pre-hospital care and transport you to a final care point, a hospital, within an hour. If you can get somebody to a hospital within that time frame and into a physician's care, your chances of a better outcome are much greater.
Franklin County Sheriff Kevin Mulverhill.
If you have a victim of an accident or some other medical emergency that's unable to communicate their problems, unable to communicate their medications, this program will provide that information to the responder and they can take appropriate action. The ambulances in all of our counties have communication back and forth to medical control at hospitals. The information can be communicated sooner to the hospital, and it's just a good tool to help them solve the problem.
The sheriffs from Clinton, Franklin, and Essex counties announced the rollout of the program as a unified effort. Clinton County Sheriff David Favreau says a tri-county approach is crucial.
If programs are going to be successful and if efforts are going to be successful on the law enforcement front, both for prevention and for enforcement, then it needs to be a team approach. What you're seeing here today is we're getting the tri-county sheriffs together so that we can do it from a northern New York approach for all three counties. People cross over the borders frequently, and it's nice to be able to be on the same page and understand what this is all about. It's our hope. And obviously, one of the goals of the program is to get every sheriff's department on board and get them delivering the Yellow Dot program out to the members of their community so that we have a unified effort statewide in New York.
About half of New York sheriffs have adopted the Yellow Dot program since the New York State Sheriffs Association began rolling it out this spring. It was created in Connecticut, and more than a dozen states have adopted it.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The State University of New York's Research Foundation spent more than $1 billion last year to support research at state universities. The Innovation Trail's Matt Richman reports on one invention helped along by that money, a hearing aid modeled on a tiny fly's ear.
The female fly, when she's pregnant and needs to have her babies, she listens for crickets to sing.
Binghamton University engineering professor Ron Miles says this particular fly, called the Ormia ochrocea, is special because it's as good as a human at locating the source of a sound.
And when she hears a cricket, she'll fly to the cricket and then have her babies. And these little maggots then burrow into the cricket, and a few days later they will emerge and leave a hollow shell.
So the fly's behavior isn't pretty, but it is useful to know how this tiny parasite finds its host. The way most animals locate sound doesn't work for this little creature.
You can tell where sound comes from, usually because if it comes, say, from the right side, your right ear is going to hear the sound before the left ear.
But this fly's ears are so close together that sound arrives to both ears at the same time. Miles, working with biologists more than a decade ago, found that Ormia ochrocea's ears are connected by a previously unknown mechanism.
If you push down on one eardrum really carefully so you don't break it, the other eardrum will pop up, and they actually rock about a central hinge, kind of like a teeter-totter.
The difference in vibrations between the two sides is how the fly figures out which side the sound is coming from. Miles took that design and made it the basis for a microphone the size of 3 grains of sugar. It's different from any other directional microphone on the market.
The end result is that if you're in a noisy place with sound coming from all around, our microphone will help get rid of the background noise.
But this invention isn't new. Miles began developing the technology 10 years ago with grants from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Now, Miles says that money has dried up, and the biggest obstacle is still ahead of him.
We've, succeeded in showing that the research was right, but the next challenge then is to turn it into something that you can buy.
That's where SUNY's Technology Accelerator Fund comes in. In 2011, Miles received a $50,000 grant to help commercialize his hearing aid. But the manufacturing process is new and expensive, and that makes it hard to find a company to license it to. Miles says that's not uncommon for inventions like his.
Most inventions aren't all that profitable.
Eugene Krunzel is in charge of innovation partnerships at Binghamton University. He says inventions like this one are still important, whether or not they can be made profitable.
The most important thing in technology commercialization in academia is impact. It's not the income. It's the impact on the society, it's the betterment of the world, so to speak.
Both Krunzel and Miles are hoping that extra prototypes built with money from the state will convince a company that new and improved hearing aids are worth the investment. In Binghamton, I'm Matt Richman for InnovationTrail.org.
Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between 5 upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1234. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.